Welcome to the Insightful Voices podcast, a show that aims to cover a variety of topics affecting the legal profession.
Welcome to the Maryland State Bar Association's newest podcast series brought to you by MSBA's 125th Thought Leadership Initiative. The initiative is led by MSBA President David Shapiro, immediate past president of MSBA Natalie McSherry, and State Bar luminary Donna Hill Staton. David is a principal at the law firm of Paley Rothman, Natalie is a principal at Crayman & Graham, and Donna is the co-founder and principal of Decision Point Strategy Group. And I am Rena Shah, the executive director of the Maryland Access to Justice Commission, an independent entity powered by the MSBA that drives reforms and innovations to make the civil justice system accessible, equitable, and fair for all Marylanders. David, Natalie, Donna, and I are excited to be your hosts and guides through what we hope will be a stimulating series of limited edition podcasts related to the Spark series events. Just to give all of our listeners a background, here's Donna Hill Staton explaining the Thought Leadership Initiative.
The Thought Leadership Initiative has been using the occasion of the MSBA's 125th anniversary to critically reflect on the legal profession's historical relationship with and the future direction of justice and the legal profession. Our sincere hope is that the conversations we bring you spark deep thinking and examination about how the legal profession has wielded its position of influence historically, how we might exercise that privilege responsibly going forward, and how we might reimagine a just and equitable future for our systems of justice and our roles as legal professionals in those systems in Maryland, the nation, and the world. This podcast series will be anchored by the same four themes that we have explored in our other programming. They are the theme of Guardians of Justice, through which we explore the role of professional responsibility and ethics in shaping and constraining justice. The theme of Reforming Justice, through which we explore the responsibility of the legal profession in propagating or dismantling injustices and inequities and spurring meaningful reform. The theme of Access to Justice, through which we explore the legal profession's role in perpetuating or disrupting the civil justice crisis. And last but not least, the theme of Science, Technology, and Justice, through which we explore the unique questions and challenges to the legal profession that our science fiction-like present and future pose.
I sincerely thank Donna for her vision and leadership in bringing the 125th Thought Leadership Initiative to fruition. I want to strongly encourage all of our listeners, if you missed any of our Spark Series programming, to go back and view or listen to them all at 125.msba.org. That's 125. .msba.org. There you will see talks by luminaries like Sherilyn Eiffel, Grace Spates, and Benita Gupta, and also recordings of our full day culminating event that took place on January 20th, 2023, that featured a Dean's Roundtable with deans from Maryland and DC schools talking about the future of legal education. Before we get to today's podcast, please note that this podcast was recorded before the name change for Maryland's courts went into effect and before the change in governors due to the 2022 election. The Court of Appeals, as referenced, is now called the Supreme Court of Maryland, and the Court of Special Appeals is the Appellate Court of Maryland. Any reference to Governor Hogan should instead be former Governor Hogan. Thank you.
Now to today's podcast. Mary Ellen Barbera, appointed by former Governor O'Malley, stepped down in the fall of 2021 after serving as the first female chief judge of the highest court in Maryland, the Court of Appeals. She succeeded Robert M. Bell, who was appointed to the Court of Appeals by former Governor Schaefer and named as the first African-American chief judge of the Court of Appeals by former Governor Glendenning. Most recently, Governor Larry Hogan appointed Judge Angela Eaves, the first Afro-Latina judge, to the state's highest court. Governor Hogan also recently appointed Rosalind Tang, the first Asian American, and named Judge Gregory Wells, an African American, as the first openly LGBTQ person to be named as Chief of the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland. The Brennan Center of Justice reported in April 2022 that Maryland has a higher number of judges that represent racial, gender, and experiential diversity than most other states. As an example, about 155 of Maryland judges are male and 151 are female. On our highest court, 57% are women and 43% are persons of color. This is in sharp contrast to about 20 states where not a single member of the state Supreme Court identifies as a person of color. Similarly, in a report released by the ABA entitled ABA Profile of the Legal Profession in 2022 showed that of the 1,400 judges serving in the federal courts, most are, and I quote, overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly white. How did Maryland get here? Was it happenstance and a natural extension of the fact that the 2020 census, less than half of Maryland's population identified as white? The answer is, of course, no. In today's podcast, we will offer rare insight into the series of events and actions that catalyzed the transformational shifts necessary for Maryland to have a diverse judiciary. That, in all honesty, many of us may now take for granted. Let me turn it now to Donna Hill Staton to introduce our special guest for today.
Thank you, Rena. And we are so honored and thrilled to have with us the inimitable Judge Andrea Leahy, current judge on the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland and former chief legal counsel and director of the Office of Legal Counsel and Regulatory Affairs for Governor Paris Glendening from 1995 to 1999. Judge Leahy is one of the key change makers who was on the ground at the heart of this transformation. She is a force in the Maryland legal community. Judge Leahy graduated from American University's Washington College of Law and was admitted to the Maryland Bar in 1989. In her long-ranging career, she has served as special advisor to a county executive, chief legal counsel in the office of the governor, Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland, of counsel at the law firm of Whiteford, Taylor & Preston, and managing member of the law firm of Leahy & DeSmit. And may also add that she was a special assistant attorney general in the Office of the Attorney General. In 2014, Judge Leahy was appointed to the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. She is also a very active member of the ABA, the MSBA, and local and specialty bar associations. She served on the board of numerous civic organizations and has been the recipient of many awards, including the Circle of Excellence Distinction as the Daily Record's Maryland's Top 100 Women and Super Lawyers Magazine's Maryland's Top 100 Women Lawyers, just to name a few. Of particular note and pride, Judge Leahy is central in two projects that highlight the contributions of women in Maryland's legal history: the Women of Achievement in Maryland History, and the Finding Justice Project, a history of Maryland women, lawyers, and judges. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for all that you have done for our profession. I can't wait to jump right into it. So it's 1995. Set the scene for us. What did the judiciary look like when Governor Glendening came into office? And why was it recognized as a problem and made into an early priority?
Well, thank you, Donna, for that very kind introduction. Well, it was 1995 when Governor Glendening took office. And out of 240 judges statewide, only 36 were female and only 29 were minorities. And I just want to point out that by the time Governor Glendening left office, out of 271 judges, 52 were minorities and 75 were women. So he practically doubled the number of minorities and more than doubled the number of women judges in Maryland. So Governor Glendening believed that justice is best achieved when courts are comprised of judges that reflect the diverse populations and perspectives of the communities that they serve. Diversity, I should add, is not just about race and gender, but also things like geographic area and practice area. you mentioned, Donna, at the top of this podcast, the Brennan Center's 2022 report. And that report also reflects, for example, that of the sitting justices on the Supreme or highest courts in our 50 states, 39% are former prosecutors, while only 7% are former public defenders. So just think what that does to the balance of the courts. So in 1995, it was really clear that minorities and women were underrepresented on Maryland's courts, and also that persons with experience in certain practice areas were also underrepresented. For example, in the area of family law, Governor Glendening was determined to do something about this. During and after the election in 1994, then candidate for governor, Paris Glendening, would ask people why there were so few women and minority judges in Maryland. And consistently, the answer was always, well, there just aren't enough qualified women and minorities to fill the positions. He didn't believe it. He was convinced that the problem started with the process. So he wanted to know, who were the gatekeepers? And of course, the gatekeepers are the judicial nominating commissions. So for those listening who are not familiar with the judicial selection and process in Maryland, let me just explain quickly that judges are appointed to the district, circuit, and appellate courts in Maryland through the merit selection process. That was first established by Governor Marvin Mandel by executive order in 1970. There are 17 judicial nominating commissions in Maryland, 16 for the trial courts and one appellate. And the duty of the commissions is to review applications and interview candidates for judicial vacancies, and then make recommendations to the governor, who then appoints the judges by authority under our state constitution. Now, of the 13 members of these commissions, some are lawyers and some are not lawyers. Some are appointed by the governor and some are elected by the Bar Association. And it's the formula, that formula that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But let me point out, for example, that the first commission, and this exemplifies a problem, the first commission in 1970, of the 88 commission members serving at the time, only three were women. And something interesting to point out is that one of those three women was the older sister of Judge Harry A. Cole. Now, Judge Cole was Maryland's first African-American state senator and the first African-American judge on the Court of Appeals. And the commission that Judge Cole's older sister served on recommended Judge Robert Bell for nomination to the district court in 1974. I wonder, if she had not been a member of that commission, would Judge Bell have gotten through? And how would that have changed the history of the judiciary in Maryland? So, upon taking office, Governor Glendening appointed a task force of representatives from the community from across the state to study the judicial nominating process. And one of the most significant findings was by the task force was that there was almost a complete lack of diversity among the elected lawyer members of the judicial nominating commissions. If you remember, I said the commissions were made up of lawyers and non-lawyers. At the time, six of the members were elected by the local bar associations, and the non-lawyer members were appointed by the governor. So
the importance of all this is that you had the people who were making the selections and the recommendations were not necessarily reflective of the broader community of lawyers and had limited networks and limited views.
Absolutely. And let me share with you, Donna, the statistics on the point were really dramatic. Okay, so out of the 95 lawyer members serving on commissions in 1994, only one was African-American and only 18 were women.
That says a lot.
Yeah. And the problem was actually compounded by the fact that Even though statistics showed that governors appointed more diverse non-lawyer members, those members tended to defer to the lawyer members who were elected by the local bar associations. So Governor Glendening set out and changed the process of the judicial selection by executive order. And among his many reforms, he provided that two of the six lawyer members of each commission would thereafter be appointed by the governor, and only four would be elected by the local bar associations.
What was the thinking around that?
Well, because the governors had historically appointed more diverse members, right? And if half of the commission was being dominated by the lawyer members and they were running the show, the governor then had the opportunity to appoint diverse lawyers to those commissions. And the effect was very dramatic. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And I want to just point out and remember here, the whole process is established by executive order. It's the governor's prerogative under the Constitution to appoint judges, and the merit selection process was established by executive order. So obviously governors can and have made changes to the process through executive orders over the years.
So the whole executive order process, that was that something that you understood was a tool that could be used to try to remedy some of the inequalities that you saw in the process?
Absolutely, because I, again, the judicial nominating process and the members of those commissions were the gatekeepers, as I was saying, that who were the people recommending and recruiting lawyers to the governor for judgeships. And that was where the process needed significant reform.
And if we just to be clear, because I'm not sure, these were recommendations that came out of a task force that the governor created?
Yes, the governor put together a task force of, it was co-chaired by Ellie Carey and George Russell, Sr., and it had members from lawyer members from across the state, and they got together, and we all got together and looked at the whole process and made these recommendations to the governor.
But the focus was clear, and they came out with some recommendations that the governor was able to adopt and implement. And so how did it work out?
There's some other reforms that the governor made.
He also
asked for input from specialty bars. I remember years ago meeting with Maida Sacknes and other members of the Maryland Hispanic Bar, and now Judge Michelle Houghton on the Court of Appeals, and other members of the Franklin Bourne Bar Association, to find out how they could participate more meaningfully in the judicial nominating process. And another thing we did was we reviewed the judicial application form itself and expanded the qualifications that could be considered. I emphasize the word expanded because at the time we were accused of lowering the qualifications. But actually, you know, at the time, the emphasis was on how many jury trials a lawyer had. But we expanded those qualifications to look at other things as well, like how many bench trials and administrative proceedings and other legal skills the lawyers had. Think about it. If you're a family law lawyer, you're not going to have 100 jury trials on your resume.
Right.
So Governor Glendening clearly had the vision and the commitment to diversify the judiciary. But he also recognized that if the judicial selection process is not open to nominating qualified diverse candidates, then the vision and the commitment of the appointing authority is just stymied. You must have a process that embraces diversity and encourages qualified people of all races, ethnic groups, and genders to apply, and he recognized that.
Was there another part of this? And you've mentioned that in our conversations that the executive order not only addressed who would get to appoint, but it also indicated that having diversity on the commission was important.
Yes, that was expressed in the executive order itself. Absolutely.
So this you were able to open up the makeup of the commission, being mindful of all kinds of diversity. I think it's really important that you were thinking not only about race and gender, but also about practice areas and backgrounds, because it really expanded the pool of potential candidates and was reflective of the kinds of matters that come before the court and the kinds of people whose lives can be so greatly impacted by the court.
Yes.
So it was significant in many ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, when the governor announced his appointments to the newly constituted commissions on September 2nd, 1995, it wasn't very long. In fact, it was very quick that immediate and significant changes followed. And I was surprised, and I still am, by the number of firsts. And what I mean by that, I'm going to give you some of the examples. In 1995, soon after this reconstitution of the commissions, the governor appointed the first Hispanic judge in Maryland ever, Audrey Carrion.
Right.
On the Anne Arundel County Circuit Court, he appointed the first female, Pam North, and the first African-American, Clayton Green.
Yes.
And you know this firsthand. The first African-American judge in Howard County, and that was you, Donna Hill Staton.
I remember it well.
But I'll come back to that in a second. On the Eastern Shore in 1996, he appointed the first female on the Eastern Shore to the Circuit Court, Sally Atkins. He appointed the first African-American female in Prince George's County in 1995 also, Judge Michelle Houghton, who's now on the Court of Appeals. He appointed the very first Asian Pacific judge, Jeannie Hong, in the whole state. And of course, perhaps most noteworthy was the appointment of the first African-American to lead the judiciary as Chief of the Court of Appeals, Judge Robert Bell. You were one of the first. While we were making the policy, you were the one making history. You were blazing the trail and making this a reality. Tell us what that was like.
Well, you know, many of the people that you mentioned in your list of firsts are folks who were part of that class. We call it the first class of people following the work that was done to increase diversity and access. You know, in the moment, it was pretty heady stuff because it was a time where you talked about some of the opposition. Well, I certainly felt it, and I'm sure others did too. Not from the public, which really seemed to embrace what was being done, but often within the bar because it was significant change and people were accustomed to a different kind of process. Frankly, you know, becoming a judge wasn't something that I had thought much about as an opportunity because we just didn't see many Black judges outside of Baltimore City and maybe some in Prince George's County. That was just not a pathway for opportunity for African-American judges. At the same time, it was when law firms were really diversifying.
Especially, I mean, for African-American women judges, right? I mean, really no examples around except for Judge Hubbard, I think, right?
Well, Judge Hubbard was the first African-American woman to be named a circuit court judge in the state of Maryland. And, you know, I was, you know, just in terms of time, the second, but my class represented, frankly, the first time that we have been appointed in any numbers with, you know, Judge, I guess you mentioned Judge Houghton in Prince George's County, Judge Benita Dancy in Baltimore City. You know, we were all in the same class in 1995 that followed the changes in the way the constitution of the judicial nominating commissions occurred. So, you know, I can talk, you know, firsthand about the impact of the work that was done and that you helped lead and the changes that it made. They were changes that weren't always accepted or easily accepted, but they were important and necessary And I think, you know, for people to understand how important it was to change the system and what that has meant for the face of the judiciary in Maryland starting in 1995, but certainly not ending in 1995. So that's why I think it's important that your story be told. And let's talk about the legacy of all these reforms. Since Governor Glendening, what has happened? Governors have embraced the kind of work and the groundwork that was laid.
In my view, Governor Glendening's reforms set in motion dramatic advancements in the judicial selection process that continue to benefit Marylanders to this day, as you just said. And at the outset of this program, you mentioned Governor Hogan's progressive appointments and Governor O'Malley's appointment of Judge Barbera as chief of the Court of Appeals. These are a result of what Governor Glendening did, I believe, because he instituted a process and a practice that governors have followed ever since.
But we haven't accomplished everything, right? I mean, what else do we need to do?
Well, yes. Well, first of all, let me just say that, you know, Governor Glendening gets the credit, but I'm just honored that I had the opportunity to work with him and help him forward his progressive vision for Maryland.
But can I stop you there? And this is really important. I think it needs to be said, and I know you will not say it. But I think that there is also something to be noted here about why it matters that we have a big enough table so that everybody can have a seat. Because your perspective as a woman lawyer who had the experience of operating in the system as an attorney, being a member of the bar, your perspective really mattered. So having your voice be in the conversation and help drive the conversation matters. So when we talk about diversity and inclusion, it really is about having the perspectives of all people represented.
Yeah,
we were having an interesting, you know, conversation. And, you know, Rita, you've been sitting in the background, but we'd like to invite you back in for this part of the conversation because you've raised such good points on the subject about other places that we're not as mindful as we need to be about change and the need for change when we look at the next generation and the face of the judiciary.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, you know, what we've been talking about. It just makes me think first, you know, you guys started touching on, you know, the key reason why we're having this conversation in terms of like, why is diversity important and why does it even contribute, right? So the loss and the opportunity cost of not having diversity, and Judge Leahy, you know, having been on the bench, you know, kind of having these diverse sort of perspectives. And we started hitting on that in terms of like, you know, your ability to be at that table to make a difference. I think that is the part, because I think we all remember when there was just in recent memory where, you know, there was a judge called out, well, he has a Mexican heritage, so he certainly can't be, you know, impartial because of that heritage.
Yes.
And I think, you know, those kinds of sort of thinking about, well, if a judge has a different heritage, that's actually a negative versus counteracting that with, you know, a judge is impartial no matter what. But when you have different types of judges and that can look at the law, but then also bring some of that perspective to the table and, you know, judges that may not have had that background or perspective can learn from that, it actually makes for a stronger and better judiciary.
Well, Rena, yeah, those are really excellent points. I couldn't agree more. And I think you stated them all so well. I think it's important to understand the causes for underrepresentation of persons who reflect this diversity in our society. And not just on courts, but as leaders in the profession. And reports say that one of the reasons cited most is the disparity in access to legal networks and mentorship. So in this regard, I just want to mention something that I think is actually relevant to the MSBA's Thought Leadership Initiative. And that is the creation of the newly formed Cole Davidson Appellate Inns of Cork. This idea of the inn grew out of discussions among members of the MSBA's Appellate Practice Subcommittee, concerned about the lack of diversity among the lawyers practicing before the Maryland Appellate Courts. And we finally landed upon an idea to, you know, let's create an inn to do something about this. And we already have a charter. We are participating in the American Inns of Court Foundation. And the inn is named after Judge Harry A. Cole, who I just mentioned earlier, as well as Judge Rita C. Davidson, who was the first member of the Maryland Court of Appeals, first female woman member. The mission of the inns is to promote diversity, civility, ethics, and excellence in appellate advocacy. And the hope is to draw diverse members of judges, lawyers, legal educators, professors, law students, and to promote interaction and collegiality with an aim of transmitting these valuable legal and professional skills to promote confidence and opportunities for less experienced lawyers.
That sounds fantastic. It is, again, another example of identifying an area of need and coming up with a way to address it in a systemic way so that you're not just looking for first, but you're looking to change the entire way people approach this kind of work and figure out ways to develop lawyers so that they have the skills so they can fully participate. So you're going to get some of both. You know, the breakthroughs, but also the change in culture, the change in access, the change in opportunity. That's really, really important to change the game. So kudos to you and all the others who are involved in that work.
Well, like most really successful things, it's a group effort. It's a collaborative project. It takes a village.
Right.
To make these things happen. And that's part of what's really great about this. It's such a collaborative effort to make this happen. And I'm pretty excited about it. But it's an example of, you know, what we can do. There are plenty of things to do to advance the cause, and we can just look around and come up with a new idea tomorrow, I'm sure.
Well, this has been a really fun and informative conversation. For me, it was a walk down memory lane. But I think for Rena, you know, as a young lawyer, it's a whole different experience and maybe a different view. Rena, I don't know how would you like to wrap this up?
Yeah, I mean, it's just fantastic for me to even be on this call. You know, like I said at the top in the introduction, in some ways, when you come into a system and there's already stuff in place, you tend to take it for granted. But I think, you know, recent history has just shown us that you can't take these things for granted, that it has to be continuously intentional. Things just don't happen by themselves. And so there has to be that intentionality. And that there, you know, the new generation of folks that are coming in have such amazing trailblazers in front of them that we can look to and look at our history and then continue the work, you know, because I think it's a continuous process, because I'm sure in some ways you have the numbers and the numbers help, but I'm sure there's a lot of ways in which the experience of, you know, a person of color or a woman or an immigrant is still different. And so I think there's probably a lot of work there, and there's probably just the continuous work that we stay vigilant and we don't take it for granted. And we say, this is really important, that diversity does matter. It makes for a better judiciary. And that, you know, when Marylanders see that, hey, you know, I am there, you know, I can actually get justice in this system because somebody there kind of understands. And it's not just, you know, kind of one perspective. I think that just engenders trust in the whole system and it makes it stronger.
Well said. And I would just add that from the perspective of someone who lived through with Andrea through that time, that we also be mindful that what may have worked at one time is not necessarily the path forward. But what is important is that we always be intentional and deliberate about what we do, and that we be thoughtful and acknowledge that the work doesn't end with the celebration of one victory or one accomplishment, that it continues. Judge Leahy, what are your closing thoughts?
Well, I don't think I can state it better than that. I just want to make the observation, Donna, that you were and continue to be an exemplary role model and trailblazer in the state, in the legal profession. And when you had to go out there and carry the banner and be the very first African-American appointed in Howard County. And of course, we had the judicial election that undid the governor's appointment. Throughout the entire process, you never, ever wavered on your commitment to the process, to ethics, to collegiality. You were just a model of professionalism, and continue to be, and look at the changes that you continue to make in our state. And I want to just applaud you for all of that and for all that you continue to do.
Well, that's very, very kind of you. I appreciate your generous words. But one thing I'd like to do, and I don't know that Rena or Andrea were expecting this question, but for our podcast guests, if we can leave them with one bit of information that they might not have known about you, just some tidbit. And I have one particular thing in mind, and it involves music. can you just tell our audience a bit about your very special talents and career outside of law?
Well, I'm a pianist. My skills at the piano have significantly diminished over the years. But once upon a time, I could play fairly well. And I wanted to be a concert pianist, but then decided actually that I love music so much that I didn't want to make it a career. It was very hard. It's very hard to make a living as a concert pianist. And concert pianists also have to enter all these competitions and compete with each other. I didn't like that at all, competing. I like to work with people, and I love working with people. So I decided, my other passion was law, and my father was a lawyer. So I decided that that was the career path that I would take. But I continue to play my piano whenever I can. I love playing with other people. I love playing with my daughters, who are, one's a cellist and one's a violinist. And we have a Court of Special Appeals band, that includes people like, Judge Kevin Arthur on the guitar, and Judge Michael Reed of vocals, and Judge Timothy Meredith. We have a lot of fun with our little court combo. And music is just, I believe, a way of spreading joy around. And so that's just my special love.
And you understated your talent, but there is no way to overstate what a very kind and generous and talented and intelligent person that you are. And thank you for all that you've done, the work that you've done to change the face of Maryland's judiciary and to make it one that is more diverse and more inclusive, and the work that you continue to do. Your legacy is one that everyone should know, and we're just delighted that we were able to have you join us for this conversation as part of the State Bar's 125th anniversary Thought Leadership Initiative. Judge Andrea Leahy, Rena Shaw.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us today. Have a good day.
Thank you, Donna.
Insightful Voices podcast has been brought to you by the Maryland State Bar Association, the home of the profession. Stay tuned for the next episode and subscribe now so you won't miss a moment.